welcome to the Mystagogy podcast. In a tradition going back to the earliest centuries of Christianity, many newly initiated Christians were prepared for lives of faith through a formation designed to deepen their spiritual, liturgical, and community life. This period of formation was called mystagogy, a word which, in Greek, means leading through the mysteries. This program of mystagogy is being developed and taught by Barbara Nicolosi Harrington, a university professor of screenwriting, cinema, great books, and theology. The program is hosted by the Adult Faith Programs at St. Stephen Martyr Church in Chesapeake, Virginia. In this episode, Barbara Nicolosi Harrington discusses books 3 and 4 of the Confessions of St. Augustine.
Okay, good. So we're going to pick it up, book 3, and just jump in here now. And did anybody get a chance to peruse book 3 and 4? Anybody? A couple of you? Okay. All right. So you know then that this is, he starts off book 3 with his trip to Carthage, that they move to Carthage, or he's sent to Carthage, because Carthage is the happening place. It's the wealthiest city in all of North Africa, and it's like a city of more than a half a million people, only second to Rome at the time. Carthage was famous for having 200 ports, I believe. Yeah, 200 docks. It had 200 docks for trade. And it had two major entrances into its harbor, two kind of major harbors. One was for the military and the other was for trade. They had 800 ships in their heyday, naval ships, to protect Carthage and to protect the whole the southern Mediterranean there. So they are the competitor to Rome. Until finally Rome conquers them in 146 BC, before Christ. Now, one thing that's interesting about Carthage was that before Romans conquered them, it was a center of worship to the goddess Tanit. I don't know if you know the wicked Tanit, but she was demonic, right? And she wanted child sacrifice. And in an archaeological dig just a few years ago, they found one area around a temple of Tanit that had 20,000 urns of baby boys that had been sacrificed. Now you have to understand in the ancient world how perverse that was, because they routinely sacrificed little girls because girls were kind of useless. But little boys were really considered, this is our line. So for them to offer to Tanit their little boys too is a degree of depravedness. So Carthage had this heritage, this legacy, and of child sacrifice. But
Carthage is also famous for its games, its theaters. It's basically got all the temptations Augustine does not need. Everything he's struggling with, the academies, the places of the Areopaguses where people would stand and talk, you know. So he's got all these issues. He's vain. He wants to be the top dog. He's a sex addict. He's a gambling addict. He loves the shows. He loves these dramas. All of it's there in Carthage. And his parents happily send him because it's prestigious and it's completing his educational journey, even knowing he's got his issues. And Monica, by this point, knew. They still send him to Carthage. Okay, so he starts off with this thing of, you know, I was in love with loving. I was casting about for something to love. And this is how he discusses the sexual stuff he's doing. Was that fundamentally, when he thinks back on it, it's like, I was trying to connect. I was trying
to experience great love, great self-giving and receiving. And I was desperately like trying for this, but I just didn't know the difference in my state. So he says, I had no desire for the food that does not perish. God, I had no desire for that. Not because I had had my fill of it, but because the more empty I was, the more I turned from it in revulsion. This is a huge thing to think about when you're dealing with people who are caught up, especially in this kind of issue. The more they're caught up in it, the more they're going to feel revulsion for purity. And so you can't talk them out of it. And we're going to see that coming up again, St. Ambrose talking to St. Monica, the advice he's going to give her. But Augustine was like, I couldn't be around Christians who are serious about it at this point, because it just made me sick to my stomach, but not in a good way. Having said that, he kind of says, God, thank you for making me sick to my stomach, because it bothers him that it even bothers him. It's like these stupid Christians and their stupid rules. Why can't I just like dismiss them? But this idea of if you get blowback or pushback from somebody who is wrestling with these things, And know that it's not you that they're angry at, but also understand that they're in no condition really to talk about God. They have to fight this battle first, and which is essentially what St. Ambrose says to St. Monica, because she keeps saying, please talk to my son, please talk to my son. And St. Ambrose says, it won't do any good, because he's too deep in these things he's into. And so what we have to do, he says, pray for him, right? Keep the door open, keep the connection there, pray for him. And he says, wait for him to get to the end of it. This is a terrible thing for us when we love someone. It's such a hard, hard thing. Especially if you're like me, I'm a fixer. And so, to say, to get that advice, you just like, oh, come on, there's got to be another way. Is there anybody else up there? Yeah. But there it is. Okay. All right. So now we're going to say these things he gets into in a huge way. The next thing he gets into are these shows. This consumes about 4 or 5 pages in the book, which is interesting, but he's really trying to figure out what it was about these shows that he was so obsessed about. So now some of the shows he was watching are literally porn. And he says that, right? He says, I found theatrical displays that were absolutely what I was living in all of its shamefulness and horror. So he's doing that, but then he's also going to these romantic melodrama, knights and ladies and people swooning and people dying of love and grief. Huh? He's going to those two and he's eating them up. And so the mature Augustine's like, what was I getting out of it? Why were the lives of these fake people so consuming for me? He says, I was held spellbound by theatrical shows full of images that mirrored my own wretched plight and further fueled the fire within me. He talks about there is good kinds of stories. There are good stories. And thank God. I mean, this is what I do. I'm sitting there reading it and I'm like sweating, but he's like, there are good stories, but, and then he has this amazing warning. Beware of impurity, my soul. Beware of impurity. That we cannot dabble in that very lightly. And if you are dabbling in it, you better have a really bad sickness that you're trying to cure. Huh? I remember with my students once asked me to watch a film that they were all into. And, you know, it was very graphic in its treatment of sexuality, but it did have an amazing vision and a very solid point and, you know, really strong theme. And it wasn't a cheap, you know, kind of easy thing by any means. Having said there, they really went there. And I told my students, I was like, this is like, you know, curing a headache. If I said to you, I have a headache, and you said to me, oh, I know where there's an aspirin. You just have to swim through this mile-long swamp, which is infested with, you know, alligators, and then get out and, you know, cross through this desert of cobras, and then, like, travel through this desert of, you know, this mountain of dragons. And then there's an aspirin on top of the hill. And you go, okay, I don't know if it's worth it. So Augustine's kind of making a similar warning, but some things he's just taking off the table. And he's saying things that are going to further fuel these ungodly fires in us, we just can't do it. Just can't do it. The risks are too high. Okay, so, but here we go back to, what do we get out of watching these perverse stories? Now, again, when I say perverse, I don't mean the porn ones. I'm talking about the very sappy, you know, romantic melodramas. You know, think Hallmark movies on steroids. What do we get from that? And he says this, I loved feeling sad. He was remembering, and he goes, it's weird, but I remember that I loved feeling sad. The shows allowed me to scrape away at my itching self. He said, the more a person is buffeted by such passions in his own life, the more he's drawn to such things in his entertainment. And why is that? Huh? Well, it seems like what he's saying is, we watch to feel something because the pattern of sin actually deadens us. And you get in that, when you get in that, you know, whirlpool, what Dante calls, you know, the whirlwind, the whirlpool of carnal sin, it actually deadens you. And that's so counterintuitive because you're doing it to feel alive. But that the more you do it, the less you can feel. And so Augustine's like, so this is the appeal, is I wanted to feel something and I couldn't feel anymore from real life. So I needed this kind of artificial stimulation, the calculated, constructed drama on the stage, which is all the elements coming together to make us feel. And that's where I found relief. There's also another thing going on, right? And one of them is misery seeks company. We all get that, right? And why does misery seek company? Anybody? Why does misery seek company?
It kind of validates it.
It validates it, doesn't it, huh? What do you say when you find out somebody else has your particular little peccadillo? You think, oh, I'm not that bad. Not that bad, right? She's got it too, huh? Yeah.
How about loneliness?
Okay, what do you mean?
You feel you're drawing into yourself and pursuing these very selfish type of passion and so forth, and you're in some sense cutting yourself off.
Yeah. No, I think this is true. I think, and if you know anybody who struggles, say, with porn addiction, and we all probably do, right? They said 8 out of 10 Christian men are consumers of this, and my girl students are, the number is climbing, my female students as well.
Yeah.
But there is this withdrawal thing, and part of it comes from shame, right? Part of it comes from this sense of this, I couldn't defend this, so it's just going to be my little private thing. And so be careful about, you know, the darkness. Jesus says, you know, evil seeks the shadows. It seeks the darkness. And it shouldn't be that we have anything in our life that we that we've accepted as part of our life, that we can't say, Jesus, you know, come here and be here with me. So anyway, but I think that this need to feel something is extremely, very much predicable of the modern era, because we're so overstimulated. If Augustine was overstimulated in Carthage, how much more overstimulated are people today? And so we're losing the ability to have genuine sympathy, to have genuine feeling, human feeling, because we are so overstimulated. Okay. Now he says this, but this is good now. He's going to talk about bullying. And he says, you know, I was the ablest student in the whole school of rhetoric. He's about 18 years old now. I was the ablest student, elated and vain and swollen with pride. But I wasn't one of what he calls the wreckers. He kind of makes up this word for them. And he actually says, even after he's described all of his issues with, you know, all these sex addiction issues, he says, yeah, that stuff was really bad and filthy and lowly and it caused all the trouble, but it wasn't demonic evil. The wreckers, he says, were diabolical evil. What were the wreckers? These were people who, he said, would prey on the younger students, set them up for ridicule, like have a big plan to take them down and humiliate them and literally destroy. You know, think about young men, right? They're so fragile. It's funny because women are frail physically, but I teach young men. Their manhood is very fragile. They're trying so hard to figure out what it is to be a man. But these guys, these wreckers, would deliberately set out to destroy other young men for fun. And Augustine says, you know, I was bad, but I never did that. But here's the weird thing. And he goes, I was ashamed of the sense of shame that kept me back from doing it. Yeah. But he's like, but I just couldn't make myself do it. But I thought it was like, it was in me some kind of a lack of courage. It was a weakness. And yet he says, thank you, God, that I couldn't do it. Because that would lead to, you know, really being in, as he says, you are now in partnership with the devil when you are maliciously setting out to destroy a person in the way these wreckers did. Okay. Now something happens. It's a moment of grace and somebody hands him the Hortensius by Cicero. Now the Hortensius has been lost. We only have, this is an actual fragment of the Hortensius. We have a bunch of fragments of this great work and everybody wants to find it in one of those Dead Sea phases because it's the thing that really cracked through St. Augustine's isolation, right? And brought him into, like, he read Cicero and it made him love wisdom for the first time. He's aware that Cicero is a philosopher. And so he says, he's talking to God, wisdom resides with you and philosophy is the love for wisdom. This love it was that the book kindled in me. So here he is in this awful state, living this nightmarish life. And yet then he reads this book and it makes him start to yearn for wisdom. Sends him spiraling into the search for religious community. Now, there's a lesson in this for us, again, when we're working with somebody who is far from God. And it's like, grace builds on nature. Grace builds on nature. So if we can't talk to people about God right away, we can talk to them about being human. We can talk to them about, you know, in the case of Cicero and the Hortensius, it's like the truth. Cicero is like in love with the truth and he proposes that. There is such a thing as truth. my sister, the one that was here a few weeks ago, she's teaching, she's getting a class ready. She's going to be teaching juniors at Regent. And I said to her, well, what's the class? She goes, yeah, we were able to pick the whole, you know, second 8 weeks of the semester. And I said, well, what are you going to do with them? And she said, what else do you do? We're going to talk about reality. We're going to talk about reality. How is there such a thing? How can we know it? Right? So this is the same question, isn't it? Is there truth? So Cicero, is for Augustine, because first of all, his rhetoric is lovely. And Augustine is a rhetorician, so he absolutely loves that. He's very attracted by it. But number two, Augustine realizes, I give all these beautiful sounding talks about nothing. Cicero is giving a beautiful sounding talk, but what gives it its weight is not how it sounds, but what it's saying. And so you get this great line in Augustine, which is a very famous line from the Confessions, and it's going to, when he meets the head of the Manichees, he's using it there, but he says, I learned that you can say something true in the wrong way, or that you can say something false in a very lovely, articulate way. And that the two things, you know, it doesn't matter how someone says something, it's what are they saying? And this is a huge breakthrough for him. But anyway, so that's another thing. You know, when I'm dealing with somebody, like in some of my Hollywood converts, you know, and they would have all these issues with the church and all these issues with God and all this stuff. And it'd be like, you know, let's go to the museum and see the Van Gogh exhibit together. Let's not talk about Jesus right now, but let's experience friendship and the beautiful and talk about something deeper, because if you connect them with the truth in any way, you're connecting them with the second person of the Blessed Trinity. And so this is what Augustine figures out. His mother's been trying to engage him and talk about Christianity all this time, and he can't have it. But Cicero just engages him to talk about wisdom, and he's intrigued. Okay, now he goes, but he comes out of reading Cicero, and he's like, I need to have religion. Because wisdom is not human. It's got to be transcendent. He figures that out. So he's like, well, I come from Christians. You know, my mom's a Christian. It means a lot to her. My father was a Christian, finally, right? So I'm going to read the Bible. And he does. He says, I studied the Bible and compared it with Cicero's dignified prose, and it seemed to me unworthy. So he's very distracted by what he calls the contradictions he finds in Scripture, that there are certain passages, then in other passages it says this. And so he doesn't like that. And number two, he just doesn't like how it's written. It's just not elegant enough, right? And so he becomes, you know, he's a first-class snob. And this is going to hold him back. It's just like the Christians just aren't cool. He says, meanwhile, he rejects Christianity and he goes looking and he finds the coolest weird sect that all the hip guys are going to in Carthage, Manichaeism. Now, Manny proposed this doctrine that pretty much every prophet who had come up to that point, Moses was one, Jesus was one, we're all representatives of the good God, but there are also representatives of the bad God. Manny believes that there is a good God and a bad God, and it's not going well for the good God. And so it's this dualism. And he says, now I was being subtly maneuvered into accepting the Manichees' views, not by the answers they had, but by the questions they were asking. Really interesting. Every time he tried to pin them down, they would answer with a question. And he was like such a cerebral guy that he would get like lost in the new question. And especially the question is the origin of evil. Like, that's the one that we as Christians do so badly. And it's just because it's hard. But Augustine he cannot understand how a good and powerful God would allow evil. It doesn't make sense. And so that's for him. That's the bugaboo. That's the real sticking point. And so the Manichaeans have an answer, don't they? They're like, well, it doesn't make sense. The good God doesn't. It's the bad God that's making the evil. And they're out there fighting it out. So he says, I did not know yet that evil was nothing but the absence of good. I didn't get that yet. There's no such thing as evil as a substance. There is no evil stuff. There's only good stuff that gets wrecked. So he's still trying to figure this out. Now, he puts this great analogy. Again, it's one of the famous analogies in the Confessions for the person who is struggling with this. And it's the analogy of the workshop. And I'm going to up to date it by making it the analogy of the space station here, the analogy of the shuttle. Now, what he says is, if you, just any person, walks into the shuttle warehouse and sees all the parts of the shuttle scattered all over, you're going to go, oh, what's that? I don't know what that is. It can't be that important because I don't know what it is. It's like, and this one, what's that weird looking thing? I don't know what that is either. So it can't be that important. Right? So he's saying that this is what the person who's struggling with the presence of evil is doing. They're seeing things scattered in the cosmos that they don't understand and deciding they don't make sense. It's like, yeah, that one I don't know. Therefore, it can't be important. And so Augustine's like, the things we don't understand, that's, you know, the proof of the sovereignty of God, the proof of our own limits, etc. But the human tendency is to say, if I don't understand it, it doesn't make sense. And that's the trap that he's stuck in. Huh? He's going to resolve this. St. Augustine's Theodicy is so famous, and I'll get there in probably the second to last maybe next week we'll touch on it, but definitely on the during the retreat we'll talk about it, because he really does work out the way to talk about suffering and evil in the world. The problem of evil is resolved by Augustine in a beautiful way. I mean, not resolved, but he gives us language that the church uses today still, if you're aware. But we all should become aware and very, very conversant with the 5 or 6 points of Augustine's Theodicy of Evil, because that's the biggie for people. You know, and you just can't keep repeating, well, God's got this. You know, well, the Lord is doing this to you, whatever the things we say, you know. And when I had breast cancer, people would say stuff like that to me all the time, you know, and you're just like, you know, you realize that's just not good, what you just said to me there. You know, God's intended, God is making this happen in me. Really? Like we don't know how we sound, huh? Okay. Now, here's another beautiful point that Augustine is very strong on, and that is this great line, iniquity plays itself false. Which means the fruit of sin is its own punishment. And he establishes this as a It's just like, you know, I know this experientially.
That evil, the wages of sin is death, as the scripture says. And that's the irony, right? Because the reason we sin is we're lashing out to be happy. We're lashing out to fill some kind of void in us. We're trying to be free. And yet, there it is. The more we do it, the more we're unfree.
But just to say, I found this beautiful chart of the consequences of sin, right? And there, it's all from different scriptures.
But the number one is, the first one is, it steals our joy. So right there, the reason you're sinning is to make yourself happy. And think about it. So for me, you know, my sin of choice is my verbal quality, right? As my father said to me when I was about 12, what was the word that he, honey, you have a caustic tongue. Right? And I got to tell you, it feels good for 2 seconds. And then it feels awful.
You see the result.
It feels awful. It's like you never, and sometimes, you know, like you'll sit there in the shower planning the line. It's like, And but when you vent that, when you use that tongue to get back some, like I said, it feels awful. And now you're stuck. And so one of the things to think about to help yourself is, what's my sin of choice? The one that I mostly go to restore my sense of self, right? What is it? And then really look at it and say, how do I feel when I indulge this thing? And Augustine is absolutely going to say it robs your joy. It doesn't make you happy. Removes our confidence. How is that? How does sin take your confidence? What kind of confidence particularly?
Confidence to speak on matters of faith.
Thank you very much, huh? Yeah, I heard these people, my whole life I've heard people tell me they can't tell their kids drugs are bad because they smoked pot when they were a kid. And I don't want to be a hypocrite. But people feel that way, right? It's like, oh, I slept around, I was promiscuous when I was in college, how can I tell my kid not to be promiscuous? Is it because you can tell and it ruins your life? You know, like look it all the way through and tell them about the consequences. Yeah. So it produces fear. Absolutely. But the main fear sin produces is that people are going to find out. Right. And then so we're all kind of hiding this, presenting this illusion of ourselves. And God forbid people find out. Brings me guilt. And isn't guilt a great thing? How do you act when you are carrying a load of guilt? I laugh too loud. I'm snippy. I'm anxious.
I hide.
I blame others, right? There's all these things when you're carrying guilt. It hurts others, obviously. Obviously, whatever it is you're doing. Blocks the spiritual truth. Right? Because you justify it and then you cannot see what you're doing after a while. And he talks about that. How many times does Augustine use the word, I was blind? I was blind. I was blind. I was blind. Why? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wrote my book about marriage and I put all my sins in there and the things that I had kept hidden for years as time went by and I'd expose them and I'd write them in there. I have never felt freer because people are like, oh, we did that.
Yeah.
And they come to me. And they're like, how did you get through such and such? And it is like the truth is all that disappeared. And I'm like, Satan can't pull anything out of my closet because you're all hanging on the front door.
And I'm sure Augustine was thinking the same thing by writing this book, right? Here he is, the Bishop of Hippo, the most prominent member of the church in the you know, fourth century there. And it's like, somebody is going to pull out something I did. And believe me, it's all there and it's going to bring scandal on the church. So you know what? I'm just going to put it all out there myself.
And now what can you say, huh? So kind of interesting, yeah? It leads others to do wrong. Absolutely. Again, we saw him saying that, you know, I never would have done these things if I had been alone. I would not have done them, right? So you, bad example. It controls me. Absolutely. Every sin that we practice a bit becomes an addiction. Every sin. Gives Satan its opportunity to outsmart me. Absolutely. It breaks my relationship with God and leads to more sins. So this thing of iniquity plays itself false. Augustine wants us to really, really think that through. He really wants us to look at stuff and say, you know, at least I need to be sure this stuff is bad for me. And so I have to bring it into the light, at least in my own mind. Now, another name for this is a line Father Benedict Groeschel used to use all the time. And he used to say, people who reject the good God always make themselves a bad one. And this is true. Like here we have Jim Jones, right? People who reject the good God, who do it out of, you know, what is it, superiority or, like I say, taste? You know, a lot of elite people, they Christians are just such bad taste. In fact, I remember one of my friends when she came to the church, she was a Hollywood person and very, very prominent and wealthy. And she said to me, I don't have to wear polyester now, do I? And I was like, yes, you do, for the first 5 years of your conversion, you know. But it was like such a snotty little comment, you know. And but she was pointing out that her and her friends, you know, just like, oh, this Christian, yes, right, yeah. So but anyway, and here's another one that I particularly have a thing against, which is Scientology, because they dominate my industry in such a big way. But this is the high priest of Scientology.
Captain of the Mothership.
Yes, Captain of the Mothership. This is David Miscavige. He's the Pope of Scientology. But look at all those medals.
He gave them to himself.
Can you imagine? And people make fun of us with the Pope. At least we don't have this. So anyway, the people who reject the good God always make themselves a bad one. It's absolutely certain. One thing happened to when I was in graduate school. I was in my doctoral program over in England, and everybody was pagan there. And so one night they were all going around the room and they were talking about what meds they were on. It's like, okay, whatever, you know. And then at a certain point, one of them says to me, well, you know, I used to take a lot more meds. Until I discovered astrology. And so she had been a fallen away Catholic. She was a fallen away Catholic, total into the huge in the feminist movement. And she was one of those second wave feminists with abortion and everything. Anyway, so she had ridiculed Christianity to me, absolutely ridiculed it. And I didn't say anything. So she kind of thought I concurred, but I just wasn't going to fight that battle over there. Having said that, she's sitting there telling me how stupid Christianity is over a period of a couple of weeks. And then she unloads that she's into astrology. And I'm like, at least my God is a person. You know, and then she's just like, I don't do anything without consulting my psychic. She said, I'm going to set you up with my psychic because I don't do anything without consulting my psychic. And I'm like, what is this? Huh? So and in fact, Augustine gets into this too. But it really showed me that, you know, that it's Aristotle says it's almost impossible for a human person not to worship. Think of that. Aristotle, the pagan philosopher, lists religion as a human virtue because he's like, all humans have to worship something. We have an innate sense of our own limits. And so this thing then becomes, you know, well, people finding something to worship. And I'll tell you, I've never met more devout religious people than atheists. They think about their religion so much more than most Christians do. They think about it all the time. But it really is, you know, a devotion, okay? All right, so here he says this now. He's talking about his friends in Carthage. No, he moves. Now they're going to move. They're going to move over to Rome, and then they're going to end up in Milan. This is the period from 19 to 28. He's got this group of guys, And they're like the cool guys. But he says, we pursued pranks. And the word prank, it's another word, but it means setting people up for failure. Like that was one of the things, you know, and again, you know, apparently he wasn't a wrecker, but that's what that word means. We pursued pranks, popular acclaim, theatrical plaudits, song competitions, the contest for ephemeral wreaths. We watched trashy shows and indulged our intemperate lusts. This was his group. And so, you know, this is Fight Club here, right? You know, and but if you ever watch Fight Club, the thing of Fight Club is they're doing it because they're bored on one level. They're bored. And so it's like this search for some new feeling. Okay, so now he gets into astrology and he's passionate about it. And he says that for a few years, I was really, really reading everything from the astrologers. But then he has an old man, he's a mentor that he meets, who's also a rhetorician he respects, who tells him this stuff is nuts. And then his friend, Nebridius, also, I believe it's Nebridius, says to him, get rid of these books. They're beneath you. You're too smart for this. And so he finally lets it go. But he says to the mentor, but what can you say about the fact that they get things right sometimes?
Some
yeah, right. And so the answer is, his friend says to him, it's chance. 50% of the time, maybe that's going to be right, or even a third. You know, but I also think there's another thing on the table. I read a book called Hostage to the Devil by Malachi Martin, who was an exorcist. But he says the one thing the devil can do is whisper things to people about your past. So I had an aunt out in California who really got into this again. She had a psychic and she used to talk to me about her psychic all the time. And she said to me, my psychic told me things that I had done that nobody knew. And I said, actually, that's not true. Somebody knew and whispered to her. And then she drops that and you think she's had power. And I said to her, if she tells you what you're going to do tomorrow, let me know. I'll be impressed. But she doesn't know. The devil knows our past. And to win us over, my grandmother lost her wedding ring once and went to a psychic at a show in, it was like a fair in New Jersey, and just popped into the tent there. They were all, you know, whatever. She's a good Catholic. But it was like, you know, and so then it's like, ask a question. So she asked, where's my wedding ring? And the psychic goes into this trance and says, I see roses. And then my grandmother remembered she had been working with her roses and then went and dug and there's the ring. And now she believes in psychics.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's NLP too, like someone who's really adept at using neurolinguistic programming. Mm-hmm. I took a course in college on group dynamics, mm-hmm. and the professor teaching was very good about, like, that was his thing, mm-hmm. and so he would manipulate the group, but mm-hmm. at one point I was just like, you are manipulating everybody, yeah. right now, and mm-hmm. no one else realized it, but he had everyone conditioned that when he wanted everyone to be really serious, and this was great, he would do a particular thing. And so he had, you know, and everyone was responding that way. And mm-hmm. I was like, would you just stop it? Like, yeah. I don't want to be a guinea pig in here
anymore. Yeah, but they can read signals. But, yeah.
And mm-hmm. it was yeah. amazing what he could read off people, and yeah. just from little movements in yeah. the face and manipulate.
And say, what's the attraction of this psychic stuff? You know, what's the attraction of it? This astrology, reading the future, you know, and everything. Well, I think it's that we're lonely and we want to talk about ourselves. We want to hear somebody talk about us. I remember I was saying to my mother once when we drove by a house that had a big psychic sign, and I'm like, Ma, why do people do that? And she said, oh dear, they don't have confession. But, you know, I mean, think about it. There is something beautiful. Confession is good for the soul. It's not a Christian sentiment. It's that thing you said, right? I just want to be free. I want to air out stuff. And I want someone to still love me anyway, right? So I think that there's a big thing there. But Augustine says there's a little more too. Just when people say the sky is responsible for your bad fortune, you can't avoid it. They're invalidating all of salvation. They're suggesting that human beings are guiltless and that the fault lies with the stars / the creator of the stars. God could have made me thin. Oh, well. God could have made me not have a caustic tongue. Oh, well. Right. That. So Augustine is into this mainly to let the pressure off himself, which is, you know, it's not that I have a sex addiction. It's this is how God, the stars have made me. And so it's a way for us to not take responsibility. And we're always looking for that. Okay, but then this thing happens. So he has a buddy who's in a Manichee thing with him. And he knows this buddy actually had been kind of into Christianity. And I talked him out of it because I really loved him. We were just such good friends. And so I bring him, I convince him of Manichaeism, and he comes with me, and then he dies. And there's the story there that he, when he was unconscious, the guy was baptized. And then when he came to, Augustine said, I went to him and tried to make jokes about how ridiculous that little ritual was. And he looked at me and he's like, get away from me. And so the guy was glad he had been baptized and he believed and he had always had. And Augustine was like, you know, well, you know, you're going to get over this and then we're going to have fun again doing what we do. Well, the guy dies. And this devastates Augustine. It absolutely devastates him because now he's like, you know, he says black grief. Everything I had shared with my friend turned into hideous anguish without him. My eyes sought him everywhere, but he was missing. I think we have to put ourselves for a minute in the framework of people who do not believe in eternity the way we do. For them, the grave is it. I remember hearing this woman, a philosopher, Rhonda Sherman, giving a talk once, and she said, you people who were raised in the Christianity, you have no idea of the ongoing torture of living with the thought that someday you are going to stop. It's almost so bad that you want to kill yourself to just get it over with now. So it's a beautiful grace if you've never struggled with that, but know that there are people who do. Excuse me?
Why bother?
Yeah, right, exactly. Why have a hangnail? Why have any problem? It's just like it's all coming to nothing. And I think obviously we can see with the rise of or the decline of religious faith, suicide is up because why not? There is nothing anyway. And so Augustine's going through this. And so he says he was weary with living because of his struggles with his, you know, he can't get himself under control. And he says, although my weariness with living was intense, so too was my fear of dying now when he loses his friend. He goes, I hated death as a hideous enemy and feared it and pictured it as ready to devour all human beings. So this loss of his friend brings this home to him, and he's stuck in this double-edged sword thing, right? The double-edged sword, which is, I don't want to die, but life sucks. What do I do? What do I do? And so, you know, again, he's telling us all this so we have compassion. And understand when you see people in your life who are flailing around, unmoored, right? Which is the what he calls himself, that he was unmoored, huh? And so that we're meant to go, oh, you poor, poor thing. There, but for the grace of God, go I. If God let go of my line, I'd be unmoored too. But that to understand that there is a suffering, whether people acknowledge it or not as suffering, that's what it is. So So what happens next for him is he finds another person to love, who is this older guy, Hierius, who is also a speaker. And he writes two books that he dedicates to this guy. One on beauty and one on, I think, harmony, says, huh? Because the orator was the sort of man I loved in the sense of wanting to be like him. I had come to love him more for the love he aroused in those who sang his praises to me. So this is alleviating his isolation, is that he hears people praising this guy. So then he himself is like, oh, I want to love you so people will, I'll be like you, and then people will praise me too. And maybe that will give me a reason to live. But this is what he calls the unmoored heart. That the unmoored heart basically keeps floating around looking for the next thing. He says, to such weakness is a soul reduced when it is not anchored in the solid ground of truth. It is tossed and turned, whirled and spun by every breath of opinion from the mouths of those who think they know but don't. There are a lot of people in our world who are unmoored. They are absolutely unmoored. And honestly, I don't know what you do. Again, I think the advice of Ambrose to Monica is where we can end tonight thinking. Where he says, so first he says, don't worry, you pray for your son. It's not possible for the son of so many tears to be lost, blah, blah. But then she keeps insisting. So finally he says, look, he cannot hear me right now because he is so lost and he's not asking the questions. So one of the things just to say in Christian media, which is my field, I get so mad because we shove answers at people in the stuff we produce when people aren't even asking the questions. And that what we should do with art is lead people to feel a question that they should be asking. But it does no good to shove an answer to somebody who isn't even asking. And how do they get to that? It's a moment of grace, which is Augustine's big point. And so how do we get the wind, that west wind of grace to blow through someone? We implore God. We make sacrifices. We raise them up into God's presence with tears. And then hopefully God's grace, you know, they'll be awash in it. And then it'll at one point break them down. Augustine had to be broken down. Absolutely broken down. And that's what we'll see next week. How he, you know, this lust thing almost destroys him. Just almost destroys him. But under all of it, right? His pride and his arrogance, it almost destroys him. And then it's like a miracle of grace. He's granted a vision. And then finally, okay. Anyway, yes, Danny.
But how many people, I mean, when you really think about it, how many people, they think they're moored, but they're unmoored.
Right.
How many
yeah.
people in the population, 50%? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Think they're moored and have it right, yeah. right answer, yeah. but they're actually unmoored.
Yeah, I think Augustine probably would have thought he was moored, right? It's like the fact that he was changing moorings every 2 years. Like, you know, he wouldn't see that, you know, he just doesn't see it. And again, there's that blindness there. But you're right. There are, so when we were in the convent, I remember our novice mister saying to us, here's the secret of adulthood. You have to learn to cope. But you have to learn to cope in a legitimate way, that most people learn to cope in an illegitimate way. They find a way to survive that is unhealthy and self-destructive ultimately. So I throw that out. What's your coping mechanism? How do you restore your sense of self? And is it legitimate? You know? When I get my feelings hurt, when I start to feel unloved, you know, I just look for a victim to caustic tongue comes out, huh? what's your coping mechanism? How do you restore your sense of self? And so is it legitimate? Oh, good. Okay, so next week we will continue with Augustine on our last thing. And then please, I'm going to be pathetic here, but I have invited this biblical scholar, my friend from the seminary in Detroit, and he's all excited to come and speak to you about the Jesus way, truth, and life from the scriptures, and it's going to be beautiful. You don't have to come for the whole day of recollection. I don't know why you wouldn't, but if you can just come for a little bit, we're going to make an hour of adoration together to pray for, just pray praise. Just this like happy praise time, huh? And whatever intentions, the will of God you have for the fall, it's not summer transitioning into fall. Your kids going away to school, whatever. But I just think it's just a beautiful way to end this summer together. This has been, for me, a great, great experience. And just like end it lovely. So do it for me. Only kidding. Anyway, thank you very much, everybody. God bless you. Good night. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Mystagogy Podcast. The music for this podcast is provided by George Serra. You can learn more about his music over at georgeserramusic.com or by following the link in the show notes for this podcast. Until next time, be well and God bless.